It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday morning, October the 10th, 2019. And we have a full show lined up for you this morning. It's going to be a rocking time here on the Dave Graham Show. We're going to be talking about election security first off with Secretary of State Jim Condos and John Odom, the Montpelier City Clerk. They're both visiting here at the WDEV studio in Waterbury. In the second half hour, Falco Schilling from the ACLU is going to stop by. The American Civil Liberties Union Vermont chapter has been working on trying to reduce the state's inmate population, come up with new strategies for dealing with corrections issues. We're going to be hearing about the latest thinking from the ACLU on that front. And in the latter hour of the program, we're going to have one of our Seeds to Society segments. This is something we're putting on jointly with the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. They've been visiting us, folks from there have been visiting with us every Thursday to talk to us about a whole different range of aspects in agriculture and somewhat related topics, sometimes far afield topics. I think we're going to have, an upcoming census segment with those folks sometime in the next couple of weeks, so stay tuned for that one. But today the discussion is going to be about moose genetics. There's been a lot of research up at the University of Vermont into moose genetics, what this means for wildlife management, and of course October is moose season in Vermont, and so we are going to be learning a little bit about moose genetics and what that means for wildlife management issues this morning. But I want to start first on the promised topic of election security. A couple of recent developments. John Odom, the Montpelier City Clerk, was at a conference, I think in Las Vegas. We can check in with him about that, of the a group doing what's called ethical hacking, where they actually try to break into computer and communication systems and see if they can mess up the election counting processes. And then that helps election officials actually say, where are our weaknesses in cyberspace, and what holes do we need to close, et cetera. So we'll be going to be talking to some about that. Jim Condos joins us. He also is riding herd on election security issues in Vermont as our chief election officer. Of course, he's Secretary of State. And gentlemen, I want to welcome you to the WDEV studios this morning. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks Dave.
And John Odom, let me start with you. Tell us about this conference you went to and what you learned.
Well, DEF CON, yeah, it is out in Las Vegas, is one of the biggest, arguably the biggest, international hacker conference. It covers a lot of subcategories of hacking, but one of the things that they have started in the last few years is something called Voting Village, and it's actually coordinated by the University of Chicago Cyber Policy Initiative. And basically we get what voting machines we can get our hands on, spread them out in the tables, and have the hackers attending the conference and say, have at it. See what you can do, see what you can't do. And, you know, at the end of the weekend, we have information for a report that we get out. And you know, I think we've successfully added a lot of information and perspective to the conversation on voter security to everyone's benefit.
That is a obviously a very, very important thing. I think most Americans would want to see our elections go off without any real serious attack from the point of view of from cyberspace, various, you know, hacking efforts and so on and so forth. And the do you think, first off, let me ask you about the country at large. From what you learned at the conference, are most states' election security systems in pretty good shape and ready for 2020?
Well, if we're talking about the machines themselves, there's a really, really wide range. I will say, you know, we were playing with the kind of machines that we use here in Vermont for the first time. And, you know, what could you do here? What could you do here? It was a lot of fun, but to every hacker to a person, when I said I would rather have these machines going than any of the other ones in this room, everybody agreed. I really like our machines here, so let me just put that right out there. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say for the country as a whole. I mean, each state's work individually, and then you have the hardware at the local level. Some are doing great, some aren't. And the good news is, I think that everybody is getting better. And that's critical.
One of the questions that always comes up in this context about how well our state's protecting themselves against real, let's call it technical fraud, because there are different kinds of fraud. There's sort of identity fraud where people show up and try to vote in two different places at once and so on. And that's generally been found to be a very minimal feature in the overall election processes, from what I understand. But if you can imagine somebody actually going into one of the computers on a statewide level that is actually doing the counting and is going to decide, you know, which presidential candidate ends up getting the state's electoral votes, the stakes are really really high there, and you obviously do not want to have anything go untoward in that realm. And one of the questions that comes up is, do these states have backup paper ballots? Is there a paper record of how well or how the counting actually went? Do it by machine. If the machines look like they worked fine, great. But if they didn't look like they worked fine, you have an ability to bring in teams of people and actually count ballots.
Yeah, that's a big part of the message of the DEFCON voting village is paper ballots, paper ballots, paper ballots.
And Vermont has paper ballots. Yeah. How many states do?
It's in our statute. I was on the committee when we put it in the statute back in, I think it was 2004 or 2005. Mm-hmm. We added that it's mandatory that we have paper ballots. And any future, it's in our rulemaking for choosing a new tabulator in the future, that it has to have a paper ballot, a voter mark paper ballot. And you know, I can't see how you can actually do it any other way, especially I think John can admit, or not admit, can say, can vouch for. If you had these one of these touchscreen vote machines, vote tabulators, essentially what they do is you touch the screen like you would on an iPad, mm-hmm, to select who you want, and then you submit it.
Yeah.
And if there's no paper ballot, I don't know how they do an audit or a recount. What do? Press the button and recount what they already counted? I mean, that's really what it comes down to. What in conjunction with that, my office and me personally, as when I had spoken to Congress in the last year, have asked that they mandate, as they provide more funding or more resources to the state, that they require paper ballots with post-election audits that have a high statistical confidence level.
It strikes me that this can't be that hard, because if you go out to dinner at a restaurant, here's what typically happens. You pay with your credit card. There's an electronic transaction that actually goes over the wires to the bank to report that there's a new debit on your account for the dinner. And then there is a paper ballot, which is the receipt that says merchant copy. And you're supposed to sign that, and that's what the wait staff takes away. And then there's a customer copy, and I've never understood if that's a routine thing when you go out to eat. Why is it that when you go to a polling place that you wouldn't have a similar system where there's an electronic transmission of what you're doing to a centralized location, as in analogous to this bank transaction? And then there's a piece of paper that goes to the house, basically, to the city hall or the polling place where you're voting. And there's another piece of paper that you can stuff in your pocket after you look at it and make sure that, I voted for the Democrat here, the Republican here, the Independent here, whatever the case may be. You can kind of double check the thing on your way out the door. And if you discover that, gee whiz, all my votes got changed to the party I don't like, you can stop and turn around and say, hey, wait a minute, this is a problem. Let's fix it right now. Why wouldn't it work that way?
It should work that way. So Dave, I think the important thing to recognize here is, first of all, you asked a question earlier and I forgot to answer it, and that is how many states? Mm-hmm. So there's about 40 states that actually use paper ballots. Of the remaining 10 states, about half of those are strictly what we call touchscreen. In other words, there's no receipt or anything like that at all. The other states, the other five, are kind of a hybrid. They may have some paper ballot count. See, you got to remember, too, the way we operate differently in the East than they do around the rest of the country, because we go right from the state level to the town level, whereas in most of the country, they go by the county level.
Yeah.
So each county is responsible for purchasing their own equipment and running those elections by the county, and then they feed the information up to the state.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit different, and here in Vermont, my office is charged with providing tabulators to those towns with 1,000 voters or more at no cost to the town. The only cost that they have is actually just the roughly half the programming cost. We pick up half the other half of the programming cost for the memory cards, and we do the maintenance on an annual basis. So if someone from the company goes around and actually maintains these machines. Not every state does the maintenance. Not every state provides that resource to the towns. So we're proud of the way we work with our towns, and I think that the towns appreciate it as well, that we're helping them. So there is a mandate. Any town over 1,000 voters must have a tabulator. Any town under 1,000 that wants one can ask for one.
John Odom, I gather that that's all covered in the city of Montpelier because that's about, 7,500 people, right?
Yeah, that's right. And we do it the way everybody else does. We've got a really good systems. And just to speak back to your point, too, about this information communicating over the wire, that's not the way it happens in Vermont. We don't, it doesn't communicate over the wire. We actually go up and physically get the reports from each machine and then go add them up. And then we go report into the statewide system what the results are. So there's no wire to be intercepted there.
Mm-hmm.
And also on the issue of receipt, I mean, you know, just a note, we talk about paper ballots. We talk about voter verifiable ballots, too, where somebody may use a touchscreen and then it prints out a ballot, which is not just a receipt. It's their ballot and they can look at it and verify that before, say, feeding it into a machine. But you don't want to give somebody a receipt for their vote because then their privacy is at threat. The anonymity of the vote is absolutely fundamental to what we're doing. And giving somebody a receipt to it would really put that in jeopardy.
Okay, so maybe that's not the best analogy, the scene I described in a restaurant. But I guess what I'm saying is in terms of the ease and the commonality of that technology that gets used in restaurants all the time, it seems as though you could create systems that would be perhaps not exactly the same in design because you have that privacy issue, or you have that security issue of not wanting to transmit the data over a network before it's gathered in the voting place, right?
You know, the problem is everything is easier if you do it over the wire,
yeah.
But everything is less secure. So you've got to decide where you want to strike that balance.
And I think also, Dave, part of the point, I think, is that the town clerks, when they're tallying up the votes, when they go to the machine and they get the receipt, basically they get a cash register receipt that lists all the tallies.
Yep.
But then they go back to their poll books, their checklist, and they count up and see, okay, we had 500 voters, and then we checked in 500.
Right. Okay.
So if all of a sudden they had 500 voters checked in, but they only had 200 votes actually cast, we know there's a problem.
Yeah.
And one of the things that has happened in the last couple of years, one because of some of the climate change issues that we've had and some of the problems that other states have had, we have given authority to me to move polling places if necessary because of flooding or whatever, some kind of a disaster, a fire or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that this past year, I received the authority from the legislature to be able, if I get wind of a problem, say John calls me up and says, something just doesn't seem right with my machine. It's just not working right. I can order John to shut the machine off and do a hand count.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I also want to be careful. Hand count, a lot of people think hand count is the cat's meow, that's the way that we should do all voting.
Yeah.
The eyeball doesn't always see what it sees.
Understood.
And
you introduce some human error there.
That occurs when that happens. But the system that we currently have with the scanner it's all it is a scanner, and then it just totals up what it scanned. Plus the process that the town clerks use, their members of their Board of Civil Authority go through every ballot. They take them out of the unit, and they go through every ballot to see if there was a write-in, if there was maybe someone didn't fill in the oval, they X'd or circled the name.
Yeah.
They look for those kinds of votes that are on those ballots, and they'll pull those out to do a hand count on those. But they review each and every ballot before they actually start packing up to go home. And so there is a process, and I think John can speak to this better than I can, but there's also, we all talk about cybersecurity now. There's also the physical security side, and that is, as John said, I think this year's DEF CON really was talked about the physical security side of this. And it's really important that people understand that when you're at the polling place, there's always someone standing next to the machine. When the chain of custody for those memory cards that are put into those machines, there's a specific chain of custody with a sign-in sheet and sign-out sheet.
Mm-hmm.
They keep the machines and the memory cards in their vaults. If someone wanted to have an army of people to run around the state of Vermont, they could break into City Hall, break into the town clerk's office, break into the town vault, find the memory cards, reconfigure them, and get out before someone saw them. It's almost impossible. So we have very tight physical security as well as the cybersecurity side.
You basically would have to pull off 251 burglaries on the
well, really, seriously,
or something. Yeah, I get you, and I mean that is important to think about as well. Not just the cybersecurity, but also, as you put it, the physical security. There's another issue that you mentioned when we were getting ready to come on the air this morning, Jim Condos, which I think is it piqued my curiosity that you would be even getting involved in this. But that is the whole issue of social media and the general messing with people's heads as they prepare to vote that goes on. We heard a lot about this in 2016, where Russia was supposedly, you know, all these Russian bots were putting out all sorts of trolls and false media reports and et cetera, et cetera. What's the role of a Secretary of State? And I'll ask John Odom, what's the role of a city clerk in a moment? What do you do about this?
So what we found in 2016, what we learned, and I think what the Russians learned as well, and probably the Iranians and the North Koreans and the Chinese, is that trying to actually change physical counts of votes is going to be very difficult, if not impossible. Just because of the nature of the way it works. We have a very decentralized election system across this country. We go from the state level, so the states aren't all tied together. We go from the state level to the town or the county level, depending on how that works. Probably the only statewide, state-by-state connection is AP. So,
well, I guess my... My real question is, I mean, are you stepping up in terms of just public education or whatever?
Yes.
I can imagine that, and I heard you say this, it sounds almost like a slogan, what is it, think before you link.
Exactly.
I think there's some ethical standards that people ought to be aware of and maybe even get this in school or whatever, but if you see something online that happens to agree with your own political ideology or whatever. Let's say you're a conservative and you see something online, you know, some purported news article that talks about the Democrats doing something nefarious or something, and you go, "Yeah, I know those Democrats; they're evil. I'm gonna repost this." Do you, as an individual citizen, have any kind of a duty, you know, in a newsroom? I mean, you mentioned the AP. I worked for the Associated Press for a long time. And in a lot of newsrooms, there used to be this slogan, which is, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. You know, in other words, I mean, that's kind of extreme, but you had a duty to actually verify the stuff you were going to be putting out in your newspaper or on the wire or whatever. if I mean, should there be a similar slogan which says, if there's a if somebody posts something that you love, check it out?
Well, I think, yeah, and I think you'll find that leading up to the election this year, not only will individual states, the secretaries of state, be doing some voter education, but you're going to also find that the Department of Homeland Security is also going to do that. They recognize that the social media and disinformation, misinformation campaigns are really the biggest threat we have right now. The concern, obviously, is once something is put out there, in a matter of minutes, hundreds of thousands of people could see it or even pass it on to the next person.
Yep.
And that's the issue. We have worked with, at the national level, we have worked with both Facebook and Twitter to develop communication channels that we can communicate to them when there is a problem, when we see something that is clearly false. For instance, in Burlington, the polling place was closed because of a power outage, but don't worry, you can vote after 7 o'clock because they're going to be open till 10 o'clock. We know that's not true.
Yeah, yeah.
But that gets out there, and all of a sudden people start showing up at 7:30, 8 o'clock, 8:30 to vote, and they find that the polling place has been closed.
That's
the problem, mm-hmm. and it's voter suppression, and we want to be really careful about that. So, again, think before you link. It's so easy. Facebook makes it, and Twitter makes it so simple to just click on something and send it and repost it or retweet it or share it. And we have to be really careful about that. And so there will be campaigns around that to make sure that people understand to get their information about elections and voting from trusted sources rather than just Facebook or Twitter.
Let's go to a caller. We have Dale from Burlington on the line. Good morning, Dale.
Yeah, my advice would be to call your city clerk on town meeting day if you want any information and not get it from the internet. But that's not why I'm calling. I was just, Dave was making a case for making voting as simple as using a credit card and getting a receipt. And one of you gentlemen just explained to him that, you know, you can't have a receipt, et cetera, for safety reasons and confidential reasons. Leading into that, and another debate for that issue is, how many cases of voter fraud have we had in Vermont over the last 10 years as compared to credit card fraud? I would say it's about 99.9% credit card fraud and 0.0001 voter fraud.
Jim?
So, Dale, I guess I don't disagree with you, except that I would go even further. I think it's many more zeros after the point. We have had, to my knowledge, there has never been a case of voter fraud raised with the or charged by the Attorney General's office between Bill Sorrell and T.J. Donovan.
Okay, well, that's even better than my 0.0001. That's good. So let's not change it and go to the credit card system.
Okay.
Well, let me just say something about...
Thanks a lot, guys.
Oh, sure. Thank you, Dale. Go ahead, John.
That's a great call, Dale. And I just wanted to say something about voter fraud since you brought it up. You know, obviously, we're city clerks are election administrators. Voter fraud is our business. Voter fraud is a concern, something we keep in our minds. Here's the thing, though. At present, it's all but non-existent. I won't say it's non-existent, but it's statistically insignificant. On the other side of the equation, you still have low voter turnout. You still have voter turnout not up to what it should be, and not enough people participating. So those are the problems on two end of a spectrum. You know, if you open things up, you might get more fraud. If you close things up, you're going to keep people out. Right now, that balance is skewed so far to one side that we need to be focusing on opening those elections, because that's where the problem is. Believe me, if fraud starts becoming an issue and pops up and everyone's coming out to vote, then I think all of us would be concerned about about that. But right now, we're concerned about getting people out to vote.
John Odom, what are some of the next steps? I mean, Vermont now has you can register to vote while you register your car at the DMV. You have same-day voter registration. It seems like the state has taken some serious steps in recent years to try to make that process more welcoming and friendlier to people. Are there next steps?
Boy, that's a really good question. What next step would I take? I'd have to think about that. I do want to say, though, as you bring up Election Day registration, that really fits into the security discussion, because that is a firewall against all sort of mischief that could be done, particularly at the state level. If someone were to penetrate the state database and change registration information, remove registration, then we can take care of you at the polls. So it neutralizes a lot of that attack right there. So I think it's a perfect point to bring up for this topic.
All right. Well, and I'm glad to end on a perfect point. I'm a little sad to end, though, because it seems like we could talk for at least another half hour about this topic. But we are about out of time on this segment on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. I want to thank my guests, Secretary of State Jim Condos and John Odom, the city clerk of Montpelier, for stopping by this morning, giving us an update on election security issues. And I suspect we may have the two of you back from time to time over the course of the next year or so, because there's something coming up in about 13 months that we all need to be thinking about.
Actually, we're already talking 4 or 5 months, because we've got a presidential election in March.
The primary, that's true too. All right, well, thanks, gentlemen. Now we're going to take a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show, and we'll be back.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
From election security to questions about incarceration in Vermont and how we retool the justice system in the state, perhaps to try to reduce our inmate populations. The American Civil Liberties Union, Vermont chapter, has been riding herd on this issue in the last couple of years, really coming out with a lot of interesting and provocative information and statements on all of this. And they're out with a new report, in fact, this week, and we wanted to bring someone from the ACLU in to share what the findings are and recommendations and so on. And they have a new person there, Falco Schilling, who's been in worn a couple of other hats around Montpelier in recent years, but he's now with the ACLU. And I want to welcome you, Falco, to your first visit, I think, to the Dave Graham Show
here. Yeah, it's my first visit. Thanks so much for having me.
And tell us what the news is this week. You're out with a new report. What does it say?
Yeah, so this is our Blueprint for Smart Justice Vermont, and this is something we worked on with the Urban Institute, and this is part of a 50-state project the ACLU has engaged in across the country to try and create concrete recommendations for states who are looking to try and reduce their prison populations and also confront systemic racism that exists in our criminal justice system.
And the Vermont has some long-running issues in this regard. Among them, I mean, I guess one of the sore thumbs that sticks out or whatever is the fact that the state actually ships a number of inmates out of state. I think they're currently housed in Mississippi. We've had stints in Kentucky and Michigan and Pennsylvania, and now it's Mississippi. And it's always the same case, it seems, which is that essentially there are not enough beds for all of the inmates that the state wants to imprison within the state of Vermont. And so some get sent to these distant places. And I've wondered many times over the years, there's a provision in the Vermont Constitution that talks about the ability of members of the public to, quote unquote, I think the phrase is, see them at their labors, meaning, I guess, look through a prison fence and see inmates in there doing their whatever they're doing, making license plates or something, painting road signs and the other things that happen in some prison craft shops and so on. And I guess as a baseline thing, I'll just start with that and ask you, Falco Schindling, do you think that there's a constitutional problem when the Constitution calls for this ability on the part of the public to be able to actually have a certain interaction, I guess, if you can see them at their labors with our inmates, but the inmates are in Mississippi or Michigan or someplace?
Well, I can say that having folks that far away from home, about 1,300 miles away from home, certainly presents a great hardship to their families who want to be able to see and connect with their loved ones. It's enough of a challenge for folks who are incarcerated here in Vermont to stay connected with their families and their communities. So being that far away is a great hardship and something that we would like to end. We'd like to see Vermont no longer be sending prisoners out of state, and also end our partnership with the for-profit prison industry.
And one of the things here, I mean, there's so many practical considerations, too, just in terms of, I know when the prisoners were housed in Pennsylvania a couple of years ago, there was a lot of concern about the health care they were receiving or not receiving. For instance, we had a couple of inmates who either died at this Camp Hill prison in Pennsylvania or died shortly after coming back from there. And there was a lot of concern of, you know, that they would go and report problems to the prison infirmary, and the staff there would essentially just wave them off and tell them to go pound sand, effectively. One guy, I think, if I recall correctly, finally, in the last days of his life, was determined to have some kind of stage 4 cancer that, you know, might have been caught earlier on if they'd been paying closer attention. The Vermont has a prisoner's rights office, which actually has attorneys that are able to visit with inmates and talk to them about what their issues are and perhaps help to address problems and so on. And yet, when the inmates are in Pennsylvania, even, which I guess is the closest of these four places we've described, when you think about Kentucky, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Mississippi, we've sent a few inmates years ago to Arizona too, if I recall. So I mean, these are not easy trips for somebody from the prisoners' rights office. They're not easy trips for someone from Vermont's Office of Protection and Advocacy, and so. That presents issues too, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. When you look at our prison population here in Vermont, it rose 363% from 1980 to 2009 and peaked right around 2,200 people, which is about 1,000 more people than we have capacity for in our current system right now. And I will say, to give the legislature and other leaders around the state credit, they recognize this as a real problem. And about a decade ago, they engaged in a process called Justice Reinvestment. It's a collaborative process that's convened by the nonprofit, nonpartisan Council of State Governments that brought together stakeholders to really look at the data that we had on what was happening with our system. Why were we seeing these rates of increase in terms of the number of people we were incarcerating and what we could do about it? And I will say, over the last decade, we've reduced our number of people who are incarcerated by the state of Vermont by almost a quarter. There's 500 fewer people who are incarcerated now than a decade ago. But we do think that there's still a number of ways that we could reduce that number and make sure that we have a criminal justice system that's fair, equitable, and rooted in community-based solutions and works for all Vermonters. So that's what this report is about, is trying to talk about some of those solutions. And it's actually coming at a really timely moment when the state of Vermont just last year in their state budget put in language saying, we are committed to creating a smarter criminal justice system, and actually have engaged in a second justice reinvestment process, one of the few states in the nation to do this. So we have commitment from the legislature, also the judiciary, the administration, to come together as part of this process. It started this fall and is going to be continuing. We'll have a meeting of these folks next week saying, all right, let's look at what solutions are out there to help reduce this prison population. And if you look at the language in the state budget, it mirrors a lot of the suggestions that we're putting forward in this report.
What are the top two or three recommendations that the ACLU has for reducing our prison population?
Well, there's recommendations we have from every point in the system. So it starts from those first interactions people might have with law enforcement, looking at what things we think should be criminalized, and then from there looking at, all right, once we actually have someone arrested, should we be holding people on cash bail simply because they can't afford to get out? Beyond that, we have a serious lack of information about some of the discretionary decisions that happen after that, especially around charging and sentencing decisions. When it comes to criminal cases in Vermont, over 90% are decided by plea deals. These are deals that are worked out between prosecutors and defendants. And there's a lot of power and a lot of discretion in the state's attorney's offices, and we need to know a little bit more about how those decisions are being made. Well, we are seeing disparities across the state. You have some regions that are incarcerating people about twice the rate of the statewide average. And then we also see that in terms of the racial disparities in the system, Black adults are incarcerated at a rate about 7 times that of white adults. You know, Black adults make up about 1% of Vermont's population, 8% of our prison population. So there are things we can look at that point in the system. And then another huge area that we would like to spend some time looking at and talking about is when folks are trying to reenter their communities, what barriers are we putting up, and how are we making it harder in many ways for those folks to successfully reenter their community. And so we want to take a look at the probation and parole system, as well as the furlough system, because we know 2/3 of the folks who we are incarcerating today are there on some violation of the conditions of their release. Unfortunately, this is another area where we need more data. And this is something you'll probably hear me say a number of times today, is that we need more data throughout the entire system. And that's one of our top line recommendations for the legislature this year, is to really look at trying to get comprehensive data from the beginning of the system through the end. We've done a lot of work asking law enforcement to provide data about the decisions they're making every single day. And we now need to ask the same thing of folks throughout the system. So that includes state's attorneys and the Department of Corrections. So,
right. There's so many issues here. I feel like I need to almost pick one at random. But let's start with this: the disparity in how criminal cases are treated among counties. And let's say you had, I don't know, just again, picking at random, because I haven't looked at any data on this lately, but let's say you had a case where in Bennington County, burglary is more likely to get you jail time, prison time, than is the case in Washington County or Chittenden County or whatever. And then the next question is, and suppose the data improves to the extent where you can actually see that, you know, in some Vermont's really a different state depending on which county you're in, if you're going to be involved in the criminal justice system at all. And then you say to yourself, okay, well, is that okay? Should that be the case? Is it a matter of your good luck or bad luck, depending on which county you happen to be living in? Or is it a matter of should the state have some kind of push for statewide uniformity in punishing various crimes, for instance? How do we get to the answer there?
Well, we 100% believe that the justice system should work for everyone in Vermont equally, no matter who you are or where you live. And with this better data, we can get these facts in black and white, and that can often help people make better decisions. Sometimes people might have biases that they just don't know about. And with that hard and data, that can lead to better decisions. So that can also help drive policymaking decisions at the state level, but also policymaking decisions at the county level as these prosecutors are looking at how they conduct their day-to-day work. If they're seeing they are an outlier to other counties in numbers of ways. So we have, you know, very basic data. But as folks see that, I think a number of these folks would want to have that information as well, just to see how they compare to their peers and how the system as a whole is working. But I 100% agree that in our justice system, your access to justice shouldn't depend on what county you live in. And we need to have that uniformity throughout the system. And it also shouldn't depend on what you look like or the color of your skin. And these are things that we really need more data on now so that we can make better policy decisions. And also, as policymakers try to implement reforms, we need to be able to track those decisions to see if they're working or not. We don't want to be moving forward with new policy initiatives with no way to judge, is this something we should be doing or should we be changing course?
Falco Schilling, one of the things you've mentioned a couple times now in the course of our conversation so far is that Vermont does incarcerate people of color at a disproportionate rate in the state. And I'm guessing that some of our listeners out there may say maybe people of color are committing crimes at disproportionate rates in Vermont. Is there any basis for that or what's going on here?
There's no basis that I've seen that that says that people of color are committing crimes at a higher rate than other folks. But we do know that, for instance, people of color in Vermont are stopped by law enforcement much more likely. I believe it's 2.5 to 4 times as often that people of color are stopped by law enforcement. And then they're also 30 to 50% more likely to be searched. This is data that we have, in part because we required law enforcement to provide it to us. And this is something that departments across the state have now, are looking at, and is helping drive some of their decisions. So understanding some of those disparities, how they happen at the front end of the system, is really important. But beyond that, we need to be looking at how does our system interact with people of color beyond that. So that then we want to talk about the state's attorneys. How does that impact charging and sentencing decisions? And then also, how does that impact when folks are, you know, involved in the probation, furlough, and parole system, as they're also facing a number of discretionary decisions, does that lead to disproportionate rates of reincarceration? So this is in part why the ACLU worked with legislators last year to introduce a bill, H-284, for those of you who like bill numbers, that is currently in the House Judiciary Committee, and it's something that we're hoping the legislature will take up this year. And I think that there's a good chance that people will be looking at this issue when we sat down with the Council of State Governments, who convened this justice reinvestment process that I've been talking about. This is one of the first things that they noted, that they have worked with a number of other states around the country, but that the lack of data in Vermont was presenting some hurdles as they were doing their analysis. So they've been trying to get past that and work on that, and I'm sure that they're still going to come out with some solid recommendations. But it was also an issue we saw when we were working with the Urban Institute preparing this report, the Blueprint for Smart Justice Vermont. We were one of the only states that the Urban Institute couldn't provide a predictive analysis for us of what would happen when we institute these reforms, how many fewer people would be incarcerated. So this is something where we've seen states around us, like Connecticut, for instance, implement some new and strong data practices. And we really hope that that's something people will be looking at, because it helps us get at the racial disparities that exist in the system, but also just helps us figure out how our system works and how we can make it work better.
Yeah, I was intrigued to hear you say that. I think if I get this right, that if you are pulled over, and in the famous phrase is driving while black, if you're pulled over in Vermont and you are a person of color, you said you're 30 to 50% more likely to have your car searched than if you were a white driver who's pulled over. Is that do I understand that right?
Yeah, actually, so it's 2.5 to 4 times more likely to have your vehicle searched, and 30 and 50% less likely to have those searched resulting in any contraband. So,
okay, I was going to ask about that, because that would have been a marked change. Actually, I remember in 2016, my last year as a reporter with the Associated Press, I went to a meeting of state police officials in South Royalton at the law school, Vermont Law School, and they were talking about how. I think the disparity was something like you were 5 times as likely to have your car searched, and so what people need to do now is to just sort of picture a white driver sitting behind the wheel with a police officer at the window, okay, and now a black driver sitting behind the wheel with a police officer at the window, and all other things being equal, those two cases should be pretty much the same depending on what's happening and so on. But the statistics were showing as of 2016 that in Vermont, if you were the black driver, you were 5 times as likely to have your car searched by the police than if you were a white driver. And your point about more likely to be found with contraband or whatever if you're a white driver, a lot of that, I think at the time, people were saying was marijuana. So, you know, a lot of folks driving around with a little bit of weed in their car. And it was typically white folks who were in that category. And so there you go. The statistics were just really striking. I mean, it was kind of, I think a lot of people were shocked when they heard that report at that meeting. And it was a pretty significant story for us at the AP. I remember that summer. And I know that there's been work by the ACLU and by the police departments as well. I mean, they've been, if you talk to somebody like Curtis Reed of the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity, he'll tell you that the police have been working pretty hard to try to deal with what they call explicit bias and implicit bias and et cetera, the different kinds of background thinking in the police officer's mind as they pull over a driver. All important work, and I've seen a couple of figures since 2016 indicating that this huge gap might be narrowing a little bit. Is it narrowing a little bit?
Well, if what you heard was five times, then I would say that it's narrowing from at least the data we have, where it's about 2.5 to 4 times as likely to be pulled over. And I think you make a really good point about the work that's being done here around implicit and explicit bias. That work is being done because the data exists for folks to look at what's happening on the ground, what's happening in their police departments. And we hope that with better data, we can drive similar work throughout the system to look at implicit and explicit bias. Because as you said, often this bias is implicit. It's not something someone's going into the situation, you know, thinking about and saying, oh, this person's a person of color, therefore I'm going to be treating them differently. But with data, you can better understand how that's happening in pattern and practice and then try and address it.
Yeah, it's amazing when the numbers don't lie and you look and they're more kind of retrospective. They're looking back at what happened as opposed to what's going to happen next. And so it is a really important exercise for people to. I wanted to shift our focus. We just have a few minutes to go here, and unfortunately, but I wanted to ask you about what Jay Diaz of the ACLU has called the school to prison pipeline, because some of these issues, especially the disparity in treatment of people of color versus white folks in Vermont, start very early, right in the classroom, in terms of who's more likely to get pulled out of class and suspended and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and that's something that I think it'd be great to have him on to talk about again. Jay is an expert on this, has done a ton of work on it, but it is something that we know is that children of color are disproportionately facing discipline in school, and then that can really start setting up a pattern, which then leads to a higher likelihood of being justice involved in the future. And that's there's a great report that Jay worked on that the folks should look at around this that provides some recommendations for how we could address that better and think about these things from an early age. And in general, when we look at our system, you know, we have a lot of very concrete recommendations for what can happen in the criminal justice system. But we also need to be looking at how we invest in our system as a whole and investing in prevention on the front end to make sure that folks don't have to become justice involved in the first place.
Just a minute or so to go, but I wanted to see if we can squeeze in a quick comment or question from Dave from Morrisville. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and I really appreciate this thoughtful conversation. Just a very quick question. In regards to plea bargaining and concerns that perhaps there's different sentences for the similar crimes in different counties, I've been led to believe that there's value in the plea bargaining because law enforcement may find more evidence to get people at the top of the criminal food chain, if you will, and that if you went to some type of a formulaic, though equitable, system, you would lose that opportunity, or it would be greatly diminished. And I'm going to jump off and let you answer.
Thanks for the question, Dave. Got to be very quick, Falco. Any thoughts?
Well, I think that when we look at how, you know, many cases, more than 90% of cases are decided by a plea deal, and we need to, not a jury, and that's something that I think would shock folks, and then we need to be looking at ways that we have more accountability around those decisions around the state.
More data. All right. Well, Falco Schilling of the American Civil Liberties Union, I want to thank you very much for stopping by and sharing this information with us. Where can folks find your report on the web?
You can go to acluvt.org.
There you go, acluvt.org. Hey, we're going to go to some CBS News at the top of the hour. Stay with us for more of the Dave Graham Show to follow.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., Fashion Forward, Tonya De Bellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we continue into our second hour of the program this morning, Thursday morning, October the 10th, 2019. Thanks for staying with us, folks. We have a few minutes here before our next guests come in, and I wanted to open the phone line, see if any listeners out there have any thoughts they would like to share about the, some of the latest news happening on the national and international basis. Certainly, it is not a pretty picture, it seems, in Syria right now, where the United States announced, President Trump announced earlier this week that U.S. forces were going to stand down and be withdrawn from northern Syria. And there was a lot of concern then that that would leave the Kurds exposed to an attack by Turkey, which regards the Kurds as a terrorist group and something to be eradicated. And sure enough, just a couple of days after that announcement from President Trump, there are military operations in which Turkish forces have been moving in and into northern Syria. And I think the last count I saw, there had been 16 confirmed deaths among the Kurdish population there. And it's really, as we mentioned, not a pretty picture there. Quite a bit of pushback now coming from Republicans on Capitol Hill, who in other realms have been tightly allied with President Trump, and this is not going over well with Trump's allies on Capitol Hill, especially among the Republicans. In fact, Fox News is reporting that Turkey's incursion into northern Syria following President Trump's unexpected withdrawal of troops from the region has reignited a fight within the Republican Party over America's role in the Middle East. Now the president is facing withering criticism. Again, this is that's the phrase from Fox News, from some of his otherwise staunchest allies in Congress. Turkish President Erdogan announced Wednesday that Ankara had launched its offensive against Kurdish fighters in Syria, a key U.S. ally in the battle against the Islamic State. And by the way, that is some of the remarks we're hearing from Republicans in Congress, in particular, are along the lines that the Kurds were a key ally of the United States in its battle against the Islamic State, and stood with American troops and fought against the ISIS caliphate in that part of the world. This does feel a bit disloyal in the eyes of some of the Republican critics in Congress, who are saying the United States is now cutting and running on these partners in trying to keep ISIS at bay and under control over there. Obviously, the big moving piece this week since the withdrawal of U.S. military troops from that territory has been the attack by Turkey, which, again, regards the Kurds as an enemy. But I think the other shoe to drop here, and listeners, I'm curious to know what you all think out there about this. Are we going to see a resurgence now in activity by ISIS, by the Islamic State, by this caliphate that always seems to be either underground and ready to spring up when it sees an opportunity, or do you think that ISIS has been sufficiently defeated by what had been this U.S. Kurdish alliance to say, okay, they're not going to be resurgent now? I don't know how to predict that myself. I'm not a real scholar of this region of the world. If anybody out there does follow this stuff closely and has a thought they'd like to share, I'm curious to know what our listeners think on the topic of will ISIS be resurgent now that the United States has essentially left the Kurds to fend for themselves over there. We're going to have to be watching that. It's really, again, It's a difficult situation. I have a certain natural sympathy with the idea that the president expressed it during his campaign and was reiterating this week some about his desire to draw down the U.S. Military presence overseas and bring some of our troops home from various places where they've been, in some cases, years and years. And gee whiz, could the United States save some money, save some of the pain of separating military personnel from their families back home, and so on and so forth, and the risk obviously posed to the lives of these military personnel who go to some very hot places around the world. Could the United States reduce that role and still have a world at least as safe and peaceful as it was or wasn't before that reduction happened? It's a worthwhile question, one which in a vacuum certainly merits, I think, some serious consideration. So now the president takes a fairly bold move to actually say, that's it, we're done in Syria with our troops being working with the Kurds over there, and pulls them out in a rather sudden fashion, and gee whiz, lots of results already this week, not all of them happy. Let's go to a caller. Joe's on the line from Northfield. Good morning, Joe.
How you doing, Dave?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. I'll take a stab at this if I could. I'm not an expert by any stretch of the imagination.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm a supporter of Trump, but I think this is a dumb idea to get out of Syria.
Huh.
I think all we've done is create a vacuum for Turkey and the Russians and whoever else wants to get their little greedy little paws in there.
Well,
I think this is a dumb idea.
Do you think that are you worried at all that ISIS itself could be resurgent?
Absolutely. If you got all those people in those jails and prisons and stuff and you let them all out, I mean, they're going to go back to what they were doing before, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. I have a fear about this. I don't know. It's not really based on much expertise here or anything, but other than, I don't know, just sort of logic or whatever. It seems like you suppress something for a while with a U.S. Kurdish military alliance, and then that military alliance disappears and the Kurds are left on their own.
That's another thing.
Joe, we're kind of losing you there. I think the reception on maybe your cell phone is not too spectacular. But I get your point. I think it is a tough situation, and so we will perhaps check in with you another time. Another story I saw this week that one would think might rile some of the Republicans on Capitol Hill was this news that the Congressional Budget Office is saying that the United States, on an annual basis now, we're not talking about the national debt. We're going to talk for a moment about the deficit, which is basically, it seems to be, in very simple terms, the amount of money that gets added every year to the national debt. And the amount of money that we are borrowing and not replenishing and adding to the national debt this year is in the upper $900 billion range, as in close to $1 trillion that we are adding to the national debt. And I've mentioned this on the program before, but my rough understanding of the economic history is that traditionally the government hasn't minded borrowing money, particularly in times of economic downturn. You're trying to pump up the economy and you're trying to help restore people to perhaps with the help of government programs. You're going to give out some extra food stamps in a recession because people are out of work, et cetera, et cetera. But we are not in a recession, folks. I just saw a tweet from the president yesterday talking about the greatest economy in the history of our country. You can believe that or not, but this is the president's thought, that we are in the greatest economy in the history of our country. And that is not usually the time that the government adds significantly to to the national debt. In fact, we had a booming economy with the dot-com boom back in the 1990s under President Clinton, and one of the things Clinton is credited with is largely erasing the federal deficits and reducing the national debt significantly. Real progress there on those issues that, again, these are things that traditionally Republicans have been among the biggest critics of the piling up national debt, and have blamed, of course, Democrats for a lot of this problem. But now we have this weird situation going on where the United States of America is we're told by the president, has the greatest economy in the history of the country and is still borrowing money like crazy because when you add nearly $1 trillion to the national debt with a annual deficit of that amount, you just have to scratch your head and say, what are we doing? If we have all this money coming in because we have a booming economy, the best economy in the history of the country, why do we need to be borrowing all this money? So if any listeners out there have any thoughts about what might be in play there, that's another issue that has me scratching my head. I don't know. You know, again, I'm just your lowly radio talk show host here. I'm not an expert on a lot of the stuff. I just ask the questions. So there we go. I want to introduce our weekly, we're doing this every Thursday now, second hour of the show. We call it our Seeds to Society segment. It is something we're organizing with the University of Vermont's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, and we're really glad to have the help of the folks up there. They actually started out a few weeks ago talking to us. They got some people to tell us all about this interesting story of sheep being brought into a vineyard in Shelburne. The Shelburne Vineyards, the sheep apparently are helping them, I guess, basically mow the lawn, keep the weeds down and all that sort of thing. And that struck me as pretty cool because, I mean, who doesn't like sheep and who doesn't like a glass of wine? And, I mean, hey, that sounds like good radio to me. And it worked out that way. And so now we've got this series going every Thursday, Seeds to Society, we're calling it, because the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences just deals with an amazing range of issues, all sorts of, the society end of it. I think we're going to be talking about the U.S. Census upcoming in a couple of weeks with folks from CALS, as they call it, up at UVM. And today we're going to talk about something else, which is pretty timely right now, given that this is October in Vermont, and that is moose. People love their moose, including the taste of moose out of the freezer that you may have captured or hunted the previous autumn or something. So we're going to talk about moose genetics, and I've got a couple of people with me to help explain what some of the recent research has been. Both teach at the University of Vermont. Stephanie McKay, I believe you are in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm in animal and veterinary sciences.
Thank you very much for joining me this morning. And James Murdoch, you are in the Rubenstein School. That's the environmental program up there, right?
That's right, yes, in the wildlife and fisheries biology program.
Excellent. Okay, so we get a couple different perspectives, at least in the way the academic divisions break down and so on this topic this morning. And I'll start with Stephanie and ask you, what is the what's the center of your research, and what are you finding out out there?
So my research is animal genetics. Mm-hmm. A large portion of my research actually centers on beef cattle. So the wildlife aspect is relatively new in the last 4 or 5 years, and it's a really wonderful collaboration with Jed. So what I tell people about the cattle is we try and make them better steaks.
Make the bit. I'm a fan of that idea. That's okay. I sometimes joke with friends and I say, you know, I fully support the idea of 99% of people becoming vegan, because that way ribeyes will be $3 a pound.
Yeah, brisket.
Brisket. Yeah.
Brisket.
Okay. Well, anyway, we shouldn't joke, because I don't want to annoy all of my vegan and vegetarian friends. But anyway, get myself in big trouble here. But Stephanie, what are you finding out? I mean, you say that moose genetics have been a recent addition to the menu, aside from beef. And What are you telling us about moose genetics now?
Yeah, so moose genetics is relatively new to moose in general. What we're finding is genetic markers for moose, basically. Before Jed and I were co-authors on a paper that was published in 2018, I think, yeah. And that was the first time that we had actually sequenced the genome of moose to actually find genetic markers from moose. So now what we're doing is we're taking those genetic markers and we're learning about the genetics of the Vermont moose population. And then Jed does ecology work, so we're trying to figure out how we're trying to learn more, I guess, about the how genetics can influence management and health, maybe, of the moose population here.
And Jed Murdoch, I guess James is your real name, but you go by Jed.
Okay, I do, yes.
Got it. Yeah, okay, yeah. And Jed, your field is more on the ecological end of this, and so I would gather that some of what's going on in really any species out there is the ability of that species and the genetic influences it is under to adapt itself to its environment. How are Vermont's moose doing overall?
Well, that's a good question. I think you had Cedric Alexander on not long ago.
Yep.
He's the moose project leader for the state. And
Department of Fish and Wildlife, correct, yeah.
That's right, mm-hmm. Yeah. The moose are declining a bit here in the state. They did go through a period in the early 2000s where they reached their maximum density. In some places, like in Essex County, those numbers were nearly twice the sort of ecological carrying capacity. And the state instituted a fairly high level of harvest during that time. So we had about 5,000 moose in the state in roughly 2005. Within a couple of years, harvest was upwards of, or at least the number of permits issued for moose harvest was on the order of about 1,200 permits for a couple of years. And that brought the population back to a target of about 2,500 moose. And the goal, I think, and Cedric might correct me here, but was to try to maintain that level for some time. But what we've seen in recent years is that moose have continued to decline, and much of that decline is due to the influence of winter tick, which can accumulate on individual moose in really high numbers. There have been records in New Hampshire, for example, of upwards of 90,000 ticks on an individual. Here in Vermont, we tend to have about, I'd say, 30 to 40,000 ticks on individuals. And so the impact there is that it can really impact or reduce the survival of youngsters.
Yeah, that is a, I mean, it sounds like a horrible problem, for one thing. I just can't imagine having even 30,000 or 40,000, never mind 90,000 of any kind of right. bug on my body.
I get one and I panic.
Yeah, right? exactly. Hey, moose out there, if you're listening to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, my heart goes out to you. I really feel badly for you. I don't know what we're going to do about this, but my word, to think about any animal being, I guess, fully coated in these ticks, right? It's pretty much what's happening.
Yeah, it's almost like a whole second layer of fur. So it's a problem, and it's prompted, you know, some large-scale studies both here in Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, parts of New York as well, to really try to understand that tick problem, its impact on the survival and reproduction of moose. And the goal is really to try to manage moose better, to bring them up to that optimal level. In wildlife management, wildlife ecology, which is really my background, much of what we do is to try to manage populations, right? We want to ensure that there's a sustainable number of individuals in a population. And we usually focus on individuals, right? Like, we want to make sure there are enough animals. So we look at the sex ratio and the distribution of age classes, how many youngsters and older adults there are and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and make decisions on management based on that information. But a whole other side to management really is the genetic side of things. And that's a little bit harder to get at because, you know, if there's a moose standing in front of you, there are things you can tell about it. But genetics really, you know, starts to get into the molecular side of things. And
yeah.
we know that genetic information is really important because it can influence the survival and reproduction of animals. So if I give you a quick example,
mm-hmm.
If you think about another species, the Florida panther, which is a species down in Florida. It's a cougar. It is in Florida.
It makes sense.
It's a, yeah. it's a cougar, you know, a catamount or a puma, all the
yeah.
same thing,
mm-hmm.
but a very isolated population. And so because it's isolated, you've had a lot of inbreeding among individuals. That's where you're mating with closely related
yeah.
individuals.
Yeah.
And that has the impact of making the genome very homogeneous. It creates, in some cases, like a very low diversity genome. And the consequence to that with Florida panthers is you see really low sperm count in males. You have testicles that don't descend, and that interrupts their ability to impairs their ability to produce offspring.
Yeah.
So there's a fitness consequence, right? A problem that comes with having low diversity. And Stephanie's work here has found that, the moose population is really homogeneous here as well.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask about that. I mean, basically, we have a problem of, as people describe it, inbreeding.
Yes.
Among the moose population in Vermont. And is that a problem which has been with that species for, you know, as long as it has existed on the planet, or has it been is it something that is kind of new?
New within about the last 3,000 to 5,000 years, is that right? So moose immigrated over across the Bering Land Bridge from Asia, in 5 or 15,000 years ago, Jed? 15,000 years ago. There were two migrations. And so what happens is you get a small number of moose that come over, and then they decide to move east. But when they do, a small number of animals move east. So they carry a limited amount of genetic information with them, right?
Yeah.
So they don't have the diversity of the genetics of the entire population. So some of those animals may have moved to Idaho, for example.
Yeah.
And then of the group in Idaho, they're going to be a bit more inbred than the ones in Alaska. But then again, the ones in Idaho, a couple of those might have moved to Vermont and so on. You sort of get the idea. It's compounded inbreeding. And then there's mountains and lakes and things in the way as well, some geographical barriers, you know, that also keep the that prevent the moose from kind of moving around a lot more.
Hmm.
So
you could picture almost an individual family of moose traveling from, say, Idaho to Montana, which is the next east state, and then eventually traveling from, you know, Michigan into perhaps across down into Ohio, up into New York State or something.
Exactly.
And as they make this transition, the younger members of the family are going to grow up together and then become breeding age, and there just aren't going to be many other...
they're only going to have relatives to mate with.
Yeah. I mean, basically, you look around, all you see are siblings.
Yeah.
And then you have a problem.
Yes, exactly.
And so by the time they get to Vermont, what are we thinking, Jed?
By the time they get to Vermont... Good question, Dave. So when they get to Vermont, right, we have generally low diversity, and I think one of the questions really is what does that mean?
Yeah.
Right, and we're not quite sure. We're at the stage now where we've documented really low diversity, and the question is that a bad thing? What are the consequences of it? So we're really at the initial stages.
Well, one possibility I'm going to get to after we're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news, but I wanted to, we're going to talk about, can we import other moose from elsewhere and bring in some new blood, so to speak. We're going to talk about that after the break for some CBS News here on the Dave Graham Show, and be back in a few minutes, folks.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And we are back continuing our conversation with Jed Murdoch and Stephanie McKay. They are both professors at the University of Vermont. They've been researching different aspects of moose genetics, and And they are joining us today as part of our weekly Seeds to Society segment on the second hour of the Thursday Dave Graham Show. We've worked out a series here with the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, which is really interesting to me anyway. I came out of a sort of a liberal arts background, and you know, I was a journalism and English major in college, and so now I'm learning stuff about moose genetics, and I'm like, wow, what a lucky guy am I to be able to branch the mind out a little bit from time to time. So here we go. And we were talking about inbreeding among the moose population in Vermont, and how this has become a problem. And let me ask you, Stephanie McKay, if I could, does this inbreeding make the moose more susceptible, basically easier targets in any way for the ticks that are bothering them so badly?
So the scientific answer is I cannot actually tell you that because we have not directly studied genetics and ticks. The non-scientific answer is when you are, well, a bit of a more general answer would be when we have increased inbreeding. I don't know that it makes the moose more of a target for ticks, but when the ticks get on them, inbreeding inhibits the moose's ability to fight the ticks, like to actually fight an infection or to get the ticks off, right? So the inbreeding can be detrimental to health because it can stop your immune system from responding.
Yeah. And by the way, I want to take a sideways step here just for a moment and explore a little bit more with the two of you, your different approaches to this topic. It's really fascinating to me that people from two different, really different ends of a university come to the same subject here. And actually, you said wrote a paper together last year. Jed Murdoch, you are working in the Rubenstein School, which is the environmental studies area of University of Vermont, and focusing on ecology. And so, meanwhile, Stephanie McKay, you're an animal biologist, is that right?
Yes, animal science department, but yeah.
And so, talk to me a little bit about the coming together of these two academic disciplines to the same spot, basically. You go first, Jed. Let's hear your version of this.
A geneticist and an ecologist walk into a bar.
Was it Nectar's or was it Radio Bean? Bar was this now?
It's secretive. No, I think that's one of the wonderful parts about working at a university and having the ability to cross lines and to meet and work with people that know lots of things you don't. So in my case, we spend a lot of time trying to figure out ways of better managing or conserving populations, whether it's harvested species like moose or deer, but also maybe threatened or endangered species like lynx or marten here in the state. And I know a lot about, you know, that side of things, but I couldn't tell you much about the genetic side other than, you know, animals have DNA and that has some role in how well they function on a landscape. So,
well, I got to tell you, I'm very glad to hear that at the University of Vermont there actually is this, I guess, crossbreeding between academic departments, because you don't want to be too inbred in your own field.
Ah, good one. Yes.
So
very true.
And so, because you could be more susceptible to being ticked off or something. That's enough, Dave. Come on, stop now. Stephanie, yes. let me ask you about is this something that are you coming to meetings of the minds with people from other academic disciplines, or is it mainly the ecologists who are singing the siren song to you these days?
The cross-disciplinary collaborations are actually fairly common, I think. This particular collaboration is really wonderful because I don't know anything about what Jed does, other than ecology, right? Like generally what he just told you. So when you collaborate with somebody, and it really is a mixing of the minds, it's really wonderful. We collaborate, at least I do. It's common, and I think both of our fields, to collaborate with people across disciplines. A lot of the funding agencies that fund research like to see that. So, yeah, it's pretty common.
That is interesting. Okay, well, let's transplant this idea of crossbreeding from academic disciplines in back to the moose here, because we were talking just before the break. I was asking, is one possible solution to inbreeding in the Vermont moose population to go out and find a couple of moose in Idaho and, I don't know, give them a bus ticket or something? What do you do with moose to get them here?
That's a really good question. So just to recap, like, we're seeing low diversity in the genome of moose here in Vermont, and that's probably true of moose in along the southern periphery of their range. So not only here, but also in other parts of New England.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that can cause problems at some level. It can affect how well you survive and reproduce. We're not sure if that's the case, but it could. And we know that if you continue to have low diversity, that sometimes that reduces your ability to adapt to future change.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of concern, and we're trying to figure out, like, how much of a concern is that? Options for fixing that problem, if it does, in fact, seem to have these kinds of effects, are mm-hmm. really twofold on the ecology side. One is to translocate and bring animals in from elsewhere. You bring an animal in, you bring its genes in.
Yep.
So in the case of the Florida panther, to fix that problem, a bunch of cougars from Texas were deposited in Florida. There was a lot more science to it, but basically dropped off, which infused the population with more genetic material, and that seemed to increase reproductive output. So that's one possibility. Is that realistic here? No, I don't think so. we're probably not going to be delivering moose to the population here. So,
but okay, we do that once again, all you Vermont moose out there, I'm sorry to have to disappoint you. Okay, go ahead.
So the other approach that's more common is to encourage what we call gene flow, and that's the movement of genes across a landscape. So one way to do that is to manage habitat in such a way that it allows moose to connect to other populations or to better move from one area to another. So you kind of remove some of those obstacles and barriers to allow this sort of free flow movement of animals from different places. And we know, based on this study in the Northeast Kingdom, that moose can travel pretty good distances. We've had dispersing animals that have left our study area in Essex County and gone to Maine, and others that have traveled down to Waitsfield. So they move around, and much of what we're interested in trying to figure out is, like, how can you maximize that? How can you maximize a landscape for that movement?
And Stephanie, what can you add on this point? I mean, how do you get the moose to move?
Dave's seeing me sort of make a funny face in the studio, and that's because a potential answer is artificial insemination. The reality of that, I don't know, right? I don't know if it's realistic.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem with just picking up moose from Alaska or somewhere and dropping them off in Vermont is there's chronic wasting and other diseases in other areas.
I was going to say, yeah.
So you're not just bringing different genetics. There's a potential you're bringing other bad things. Aside from the fact that picking them up and moving them such a far distance will also stress them, and what would their health be like when they got here? When it comes to artificial insemination, it's something we do in agriculture all the time. But, you know, to do that, you'd have to – that's not been done in moose. And there's a science and an art to that, and I don't know if it's realistic. Like, with some species, it's just very difficult to actually – to do that.
Yeah.
So
Once having been chased, I was in a little cloth-top Jeep and with a friend. We were going fishing up in the Northeast Kingdom and came around a tight corner in the wooded logging road and interrupted a couple of moose who were thinking about maybe making baby moose. And the bull moose of the two put its head down and started marching toward our little cloth-top Jeep. Oh. And we were a little concerned there, and my friend who was driving was backing up very carefully and slowly and saying, okay, we're going to leave now. Didn't mean to bother you guys, et cetera, et cetera. It was quite a funny scene looking back on it all at the time. We were both a little nervous. I guess trying to picture artificial insemination with an animal it is a wild animal, and they are big and they can get mean sometimes, might be tough.
Yeah. There's some, like, just, and not to mention, you'd have to have somewhere, there's a lot of issues with the idea of it, right? You'd have to have somebody to fund it. And who's going to pay tons of money, you know, to store, to gather and store moose semen. You know, who are you going to get to approach a wild female? You know, right? Yeah. Like, I don't, So theoretically it's possible. The reality is I don't think it will happen.
Yeah. So any other ideas here? Or we can't move the animals because of worry about them bringing disease. Don't want to do artificial insemination because of these practical issues. Anything else out there?
So it's really, you know, trying to focus on habitat management to make sure there's that connectivity between population to population. And that does bring us back to this study as well. Part of what we're doing now is collecting genetic samples of moose from across the Northeast. Yeah. So that not only includes New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont, Massachusetts, New York but also up in Quebec. And those samples give us the ability to really take a snapshot of what the genetics of the population looks like. And not only that, how we expect animals to be moving across this landscape. And that provides a good guide to how you might approach this issue of connectivity. If we see, you know, routes of movement of genes, at least, going through particular areas or associated with certain forest types or other conditions.
Speaking of connectivity, it seems to be just a ton of connectivity sometimes between the topics we talk about here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, because last week I had on some folks from the Nature Conservancy and a couple of other environmental groups working on building or establishing a new wildlife corridor across Route 100, right up here on the Waterbury-Stowe line. And they were talking about, you know, how do we get, how do we make sure that these animals can get back and forth across our own little neighborhood right around here, and how important that one particular wildlife corridor is. And so we had quite a conversation about that, and it just sounds to me like here's a case where you know, one type of wildlife you want to be able to use such a wildlife corridor would have to be the moose, right?
Yes, and that's a really important corridor area. They call it the Shootsville Corridor.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And we have noticed that one of the moose that I mentioned before that dispersed, that left our study area in the Northeast Kingdom and went down to Waitsfield, it seems as though that moose traveled through that corridor as it made its way south, based on our tracking devices, right? So we have evidence that it's being used.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Other studies as well that we've worked on related to species like marten also appear to use that region as well. So that's kind of the approach we're talking about,
yep. Like
finding those places that are key connectors.
Did it stop at the Cabot Annex and pick up a block of cheddar on the way?
I'm sure they did. Who wouldn't, right?
I joke around too much sometimes, but it is kind of amazing when you think about the interconnectedness of all these human activities that we do, including studies like the ones in being engaged in by my guests, Stephanie McKay and Jed Murdoch of the University of Vermont, and the wildlife that are out there. I don't know. I let my imagination run too wild sometimes, but I really, it's quite an impressive thing to think about a moose saying, I'm going to leave the Northeast Kingdom and head down to Waitsfield and see if I can
looking for a partner
mate, as we say. Who's a little different from me. I want somebody who doesn't maybe look as much like me as the moose around here do. Anyway, I wanted to ask my two guests here, Jed Murdoch and Stephanie McKay. I just saw another news release out of the University of Vermont popped into my phone this morning, and talking about moose of all things. So while we have you here. The headline here is Naturally Occurring Fungi Could Help Curb Moose Tick Plague. UVM entomologists find. So now you got to bring in the bug people, never mind the animal biologists and the ecologists. So
right, there's another piece to this as well. So if you're interested in trying to reduce the impacts of ticks on moose, what do you do? That's really the grand question.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And one possibility is to try to control or reduce tick numbers. And you could potentially do that through changes in land management or forestry practices, right? You try to get rid of that ideal suitable habitat for ticks. That's one possibility. Another is to reduce the density of moose, and that's a tactic the Vermont Fish and Wildlife has taken. A lower density means ticks just aren't moving around the landscape as easily and as readily. Another option is this sort of biocontrol route that I think you're referencing here. There's been some studies by colleagues at the University of Vermont that have been using or looking at the role of naturally occurring fungus at interrupting some of the life stages and killing certain life stages of ticks. So,
yeah. It says here more than 30,000 moose tick larvae have taken up residence at a lab. This is the where this entomology, these entomology folks are working. Entomologists Bruce Parker and Margaret Skinner are involved in demonstrating that natural biopesticide formulations containing fungi, like, Latin name coming up here, folks.
If we can help you with that, yeah.
Looks like Metarhizum anisplii or something. Well, pardon me. I obviously butchered that. It wasn't even a chance of butchering it. It was an obvious butchering right there. have the potential to derail the moose tick epidemic. And the next sub-headline on this thing, I haven't read the – you can tell this is all fresh to me, coming to me right now, folks, off my iPhone here. But the next sub-headline in this press release is horror movie. So it's kind of got me curious, but I don't want to go into this any more deeply because we only have a few minutes left here on the Dave Graham Show and WDEV. And I wouldn't want to leave this the listeners all on the edges of their seats out there wondering about this. But maybe we'll have to do another segment here just about these fungi, because it sounds like they might be part of at least a partial solution to this really bad epidemic of ticks getting on moose around these parts.
Yeah, that's right. Much of that work is also being done by Cheryl Frank, who is growing ticks. And again, the idea is that you can use these fungi to potentially kill off ticks. And that's one of the aims of the studies, to find out what fungus might work and how effective could they be in the field.
So. Is the proper pronunciation fungi or fungi? I don't know. I mean, I'm curious.
Well,
now.
Bring someone else from another department.
As a radio guy, I was leaning toward fun guy, but maybe that's just a sign that I'm kind of a fun guy myself. So I don't know. Anyway, we're having all sorts of fun. Speaking of which, on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, and the segment, once again, I just want to remind folks, this is a terrific little collaboration I think we've got going here with the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. We're calling it Seeds to Society. And every Thursday, we bring in folks from this wide and varied section of the University of Vermont. And even now today, someone from the Rubenstein School. What is the full name of the Rubenstein School, Jed?
Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources.
Okay. And that's... I'm really, really glad you have made this pretty strong connection now with the University of Vermont and have a good pipeline of guests to come on. And we're going to devote the second hour of Thursday's program in the weeks and months to come, I think, to a whole wide range of different subjects that that these folks are delving into up there at the University of Vermont. I think a terrific opportunity for me and for our listeners. If I sound like I'm psyched about it, there's a good reason for that. So anyway, I wanted to get your thoughts, Stephanie, just in the few minutes we have left, on kind of the future path forward here. As you study moose genetics and you try to figure out how to solve the problem of too much inbreeding, a possible weakening of the population against its onslaught by ticks, where to from here in the next 5 years?
Yeah, so there's a couple things to point out. One is that utilizing moose genetics for management, Vermont's the first state to be able to do that. So where to from here is we're going to have to see. It's a pioneer. We're going to have to forge a path and see what happens. The other thing is, even though we know about moose genetics, we don't know all there is to know. Mm-hmm. So there's roughly 3 billion base pairs in a moose genome, a mammalian genome. We are looking at 150 of those. So the next step is to find out everything we know about all 3 billion. And to do that, we're enlisting the help of some folks at New England Biolabs in Massachusetts are helping. And another component to this whole project is there's actually collaborators across the U.S. beyond just Jed and I here in this room. So it really is an interdisciplinary collaboration. And there's a lot of work to go. Like what's inhibiting our, any scientist will tell you this, but what's inhibiting our future route is funding, right? Like wildlife funding is, funding for any science is difficult to come by. But but wildlife, I think, is harder still. That's my personal opinion.
All right. Jed, very quickly, your thoughts about next steps.
Well, lots of next steps. I think it would be, you know, as I mentioned, great to try to figure out how these genes are kind of moving across the landscape and to think about how that could be applied to a management.
All right. Well, my guests have been Jed Murdoch and Stephanie McKay of the University of Vermont, Moose Genetics, in our Seeds to Society segment here on the Thursday Dave Graham Show. And I want to thank you very much both for coming in. That's going to about do it for our show today. It's always a pleasure to participate here. And tune in tomorrow for another edition. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre and Common Sense Radio, folks. Have a great day, everybody.